All right. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this October 31st meeting of the Herring River Executive Council. My name is Carol Ridley. I am project coordinator for the Herring River Restoration Project, and I would invite the members of the Executive Council who are present this afternoon to please introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Debbie Freeman. I'm on the Wellfleet Board of Health, and I was appointed by the Wellfleet Select Board to sit on this committee.
Helen Miranda Wilson, same here. I was appointed to be on this committee and have been working on this issue in various ways, on committees and off, for many, many years.
My name is Jeff Sanders. I'm the Division Chief for Natural Resource Management and Science at Cape Cod National Seashore. And I, Carol, I did just get a message from Jen. She's trying to join as we speak, so
Okay,
she'll
terrific.
hopefully be on in the next minute or two.
Okay, wonderful. Great. Well, thank you. And I know we also do have present a number of members of our technical team, representatives of the Friends of Herring River, and representatives of the stakeholders group, and many other friends and colleagues and stakeholders from the community. So, welcome all. And let's get underway. Let me just share screen here and we can get started with our agenda for this afternoon. Bear with me for just one second. All right. Are you seeing the full slide? Okay, terrific. And we'll just move right on to our agenda. And our first order of business is now the approval or acceptance of the minutes of September 19th, which was the most recent Herring River Executive Council meeting. We
Hey,
can do that by.
Carol, just so you know, it doesn't like you look like you're in full presentation mode, at
Oh, it
least on
doesn't.
something.
Okay. Let me just do this then. I can swap displays. How does that? How is
Yep,
that?
that's
Okay.
perfect.
All
Yep.
right. Great. Thank you for letting me know. Helen?
Yes, respectfully, thank you for doing the minutes. A standard thing, and it's required under the open meeting law, is any document or, let's say, collection of material that's presented for discussion. At the end of the minutes, there should be a list with links to that, which is standard. And that's actually an efficiency thing too, but it is required in the open meeting law. So, if there's some document that we're screen sharing or even that's brought to discussion, there needs to be a reference to it just so somebody could look it up. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that input, Helen. All right. So I guess I would invite the Executive Council members to indicate your acceptance of the minutes if you are otherwise, in agreement with them.
I accept the minutes, Debbie.
Jeff accepts the minutes.
I accept the minutes too with that one caveat.
Thank you. Noted for future reference. Thank you.
Or you could do it for this one too, actually.
Okay, very good. I
It's
will.
I'm not we're not voting right now. I'm going with that, but it is an amendment to the minutes. Okay. Thank you.
Noted. Thank you, Helen. All right, then let's move into the project update. And we'll start with an update on bridge construction. And I'd like to welcome Wes from Environmental Partners to give us an update. Good afternoon, Wes.
Thanks, Carol. Hello to all the Executive Council members. So we are fully enveloped in construction down at the Tuquesset Neck River Bridge, our Tuquesset Neck Road Bridge, rather. As I'm sure a lot of you have seen if you've been down there any time in the past year. Currently, we are focused on Phase 2B, or of the bridge construction. So, as you can see on the slide, this is the red outlined area. This is the Southern Bay. So as you come from town down Tuquesset Neck Road Bridge, you're going to hit this first bay. So we're currently building the first pier and the abutment that you hit when you come onto the bridge itself. You know, the contract sum to date is $31.2 million. We've worked through roughly 47% of that, or $14.6 million, through the end of September. And we've executed change orders on the order of $1.35 million. Carol, you can go to the next slide. Do you have this? Oh, there we go. All right. So just to kind of demonstrate what we've been doing since we last met, I think the last time we met, we were possibly just getting the temporary bridge really in place. Once that's in, we were really able to take a bite out of the existing dike there. So as you can see on the picture on the left here, we started off by excavating the stage 2B coffer cell. This is where those two components are, the abutment and the first pier, are going. We've excavated roughly 8,000 cubic yards of material from that coffer cell and hauled that material over to the pole dike road staging area. You can go to the next slide. Once we got down to the bottom of the hole, which is roughly elevation -9, we installed 16-inch diameter piles to an elevation of -52. And these are all, they count roughly 85 piles in there. And those are integrated into the footings of both the pier, the abutment, and also in between the pier and the abutment, there's a gate panel footing. And those are where all the water control gates that will, you know, ultimately be installed and control the flow of water will be installed. So those have all been installed. Those get filled with concrete and then rebar installed that ties into the footings. We can go to the next slide. Once the piles have all been driven, we have formed up, tied rebar, and installed concrete. On the picture on the left, you can see this is a footing, a typical footing. This is the pier. You can see being pumped in. And then ultimately, we poured the stem wall, which is in the right photo, just behind the crane. That's going to carry the bridge. And then on the left side of this is the abutment. This is actually a planter wall, or a planter rather, that's going to act as a kind of a bioretention drainage pit for our drainage system. So our drainage is going to come down, and there's going to be plantings in this area that will then percolate down and act as your drainage. So that's where we stand now. Our next few weeks are going to be, you know, encapsulated working on this pier, this bigger picture on the right. Or rather abutment, getting all that concrete installed, and then working within this coffer cell to get the bridge deck on and get out of that hole. We anticipate finishing stage 2B early 2025, which we'll then have a pretty exciting step. If we want to go to the next slide, Carol. So once we, you know, once we complete this area on the right side of this of the diagram here, you know, we get the abutment in, we get the pier in, we install the bridge deck, and then we're going to install these 5 gate panels for our control of water for stage 3. This is going to be when we ultimately shift the tidal flow from the existing culverts where they've been flowing from since the 70s when those were installed into a new area, and that's going to allow us to work north across the bridge, getting the second pier in and the northern bridge abutment. We anticipate that happening, like I said, in early 2025, and we'll be, you know, fully enveloped in working on that stage 3 construction for the remainder of 2025. And I anticipate the bridge construction completing in spring of 2026. And that's where we stand. There's been a lot of exciting progress, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anybody might have.
Before we move on, Helen?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Yes, Wes, may we know more about the planters? You've heard me ask questions and, you know, voice concerns about using planters in that location. Is the bottom of those concrete containers, are the bottoms going to be permeable? what kind of soil is going to be put in there, and what are these plantings that you're suggesting are going to be able to withstand whatever would go into a storm drain, which includes a lot of salt. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the thing that we should all keep in mind is that we've had two serious droughts. We're in the middle of one now, again. It's not as severe as the one last summer, but this is going to be a pattern. And during that time, at least once a week, I guess the DPW is going to have to go and water whatever's in there, because otherwise it will die and be ineffective. So may we know a little more about what's going to go into the planters? Are they permeable? And who's going to be maintaining whatever is planted? And do you know what is going to be planted yet? Thank you.
These are good questions. So I can speak to the material itself. There's going to be a lot of native backfill material, sand, within those planters itself, and that's going to be brought up to an elevation where there's going to be essentially a under drain, like a French drain type system that's installed there. So the stormwater will run off into the planter, run through the material, the planting material, which I'll have to follow up, but I envision some sort of loamy sand material as that substrate. Once it percolates down there to that French drain type structure, it will run out through weep holes that are installed in the side of that planter wall. And then once any additional water that's encapsulated in that planter, there's weep holes at the very bottom of the planter wall itself that would allow water to percolate out. In terms of the plantings, I agree with you. I think they would definitely have to be, salt tolerant and drought resistant. I don't have those plantings off the top of my head, but I can definitely get that information for you. And I would anticipate that being folded into the long-term O&M plan. Ideally, we'd have a plant that doesn't require babysitting, because, the DPW has a lot to do, these planters notwithstanding. So I think it's a good conversation, and I'll get more information for you on those specific plantings if you'd like.
May I say one more thing, which is thank you. Ironically, a very brackish water tolerant plants are Phragmites. And the thing is, Phragmites typically like to have their feet in the water, but mm-hmm. they can manage fresh water and they can manage brackish. They can't manage straight salt. And I'm concerned, as someone who had her nose in the budget for years, that this is going to be something which will pile onto the DPW's, work forever, which is one of the reasons I was against using this kind of drainage. But thank you for answering the question.
You're welcome. And I will, I'll try to get more specifics on the plantings themselves.
For the next meeting, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions for Wes? All right, great. Thank you very much, Wes. Great report.
Yep.
Right. So we'll move on with updates on some other of the project elements. And we wanted to provide you with an update on the status of the low-lying road and culvert replacement project, which is an important component of the phase one work. So just to recap, there are approximately 2 non-contiguous miles of roadway, most of which is in Wellfleet, but 671 linear feet are also located in Truro, that will be elevated. This involves Old County Road, Bound Brook Island Road, Pole Dyke and High Toss Roads, and a portion of Way 672. And along these roads, in addition to road increase in elevation, there will be the replacement of 7 culverts, of which 2 are located in Truro. And so this figure, which may be difficult to see at this scale, essentially shows in green the segments of roadway that would be elevated. The yellow stretches are stretches of roadway that are not proposed to be elevated. I would note that what is currently contemplated within the town of Wellfleet is the additional paving of the areas between the work zones. So those yellow segments in Wellfleet, although they would not be elevated, would be milled and resurfaced as part of the road work to provide a more continuous smooth road surface once the road work is completed. There's also proposed mitigation on three residential properties that are adjacent to these roadways. And there are grant funds secured for the design and construction of this element of the project from our state and federal partners, USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, NOAA, and Massachusetts Division of Ecological Restoration. So this project work has been underway for some time, the design work, I should say. And over the past year or so, there have been, you know, since the receipt of environmental permits, as we've gotten into that final stage of preparing construction drawings and bid documents, there have been a number of, you know, refinements to the design of the roadways, really to enhance their long-term maintenance. So there was additional geotechnical work done to confirm the stability of the embankments. So since those portions of roadway will be elevated, the embankments will be extended. And so that work was confirmed, the stability of those, the substrate to bear that additional weight was confirmed. There were some modifications to culvert designs to address, to provide additional scour protection under different hydrologic conditions that will extend the design life and minimize any long-term maintenance costs. The road profiles were adjusted to enhance stormwater management, and the design team worked closely with the water commissioners to relocate a water line in a manner that they felt was appropriate. So that has also been incorporated into the project plans. In addition, we took a look at the elevation plans in light of new data available through, you know, pertaining to the overwash conditions at Duck Harbor, and worked with Woods Hole Group, which is the firm that has been doing all of the hydraulic and hydrodynamic modeling incorporated in the project planning and design, and asked them to look at the road plans in light of changing conditions. They found that certainly the road plans will vastly improve the resilience of these segments of roadway in terms of providing additional elevation for sure, as well as the enlarged culverts, which will convey water much more efficiently. And of course, the project itself, which will remove tidal restrictions at High Toss Road where it crosses the marsh and at the Chequesset Neck current bridge construction site, those elements of the project will enhance drainage. So to the extent that there are events that occur, the water will be able to drain out of the system much, much more quickly. Blockage or lack of drainage has been a major cause of some of the flooding episodes that have been experienced in town over recent winters. So, the analysis did identify that under certain severe storm conditions that are very rare, some of the segments could experience some overtopping, but that the overtopping would recede within hours as the tide recedes, because of course we're now going to have that drainage out through High Toss and Chequesset Neck. These conditions could be further managed by configuration of the tide gates. It's also worth noting that as we worked with the Cape Cod National Seashore on road widening easements for this work, because as we noted, the embankments will encroach into some seashore property as well as some private properties for which we've obtained easements. The seashore worked with the town to provide wider easements in some areas where that potential overtopping could occur, so that in the future, if additional resilience work is needed on those roadways, that would be authorized within the scope of that road widening easement. You may recall that those were just approved at town meeting this fall. So in terms of schedule from this point forward, final design is very close to completion. Draft documents are being reviewed by a variety of parties. It is conceivable that bidding could occur sometime in this late calendar year or very early next year, with a construction start sometime in the winter or spring of 2025. Again, this is an estimated schedule. We're still working things through, but that is our current working schedule. As noted, the town meeting just a few weeks ago approved a layout of a portion of roadway that was necessary for the taking of the road widening easements provided by the National Park Service. So those matters have been addressed, and now final steps in those two processes will be undertaken at the select board level. The select board will vote an order of taking for the road layout, and also to accept the road widening easements, which are currently being drafted by the town council and council for the park service. In the spring, there will be a couple of additional warrant articles related to the road work, but in both Wellfleet and Truro. So we'll have those on the warrants for those two meetings. Before we move on to the next element, I'll just stop there to see if there are any questions about the low road culvert replacement element of the project. Okay, I'm not seeing any hands go up, so I will keep moving along here. Oh, I do see a hand up. I guess I will ask the executive council if they want comments from the public to be heard during public comment, or if you would entertain them now. Helen? Oops, you're on mute, Helen.
Sorry. If it's a question that could be answered in a better way in context, like now, yes. But if there's a comment, I feel it should wait till later, in my opinion. What do the rest of us feel?
I'm fine with what Helen said.
Likewise.
All right, so if there's a clarifying question and not a comment, that is the nature of input at this point. So is there, Josh Yeston, do you have a clarifying question?
Yes, hi, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to ask a question. Who is the ultimate authority and body to decide which roads are elevated? Is it this committee?
So the road plans have been developed in consultation with the town and the seashore, both as project partners, and have gone through environmental permitting. The funding for that work has been approved by funding partners. So there's been a lengthy review and discussion to determine the work that was deemed, I guess, necessary mitigation for phase one of the restoration project. And it's involved the input of all of those parties. I guess the one last comment I would make, and I certainly invite other town representatives or executive council members to weigh in, would be that any matters that involve town roadways would be under the jurisdiction of the town ultimately to make a determination.
Helen, can I say something?
Of course.
Yeah, so that's a good question. One should always know who are the deciders. And Carol was absolutely accurate, but I want to add that there's always a layer of scrutiny provided with recommendations, usually by the Herring River Technical Team. And our DPW director, Jane Norton, is a member of that team and very valuable in these discussions. So it isn't just the committees, the bodies that Carol mentioned, but this kind of screening committee who are the scientists and the, you know, wetland restoration specialists. So it gets a lot of decision making. And then the last thing is it goes through the select board, really. Does that sound right to you, Carol?
Yes, Helen, thank you.
Thank you.
If I could ask a short follow-up, if it was decided to raise more of existing roads that are being raised or raise new roads, which organization would be appropriate to propose that? Or is it any of the stakeholders could theoretically propose it?
Well, I think part of the question would stem from, you know, the owner of the roadway in question.
Yeah, that was a mistake, Carol.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
Okay, thank you very much.
Another clarifying question from Dave Poots.
Yes, thank you, Carol. I have a quick question on the slide where you showed the colors of raising the roads. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Poldike, and the Poldike that I live near was not included, but I believe it's going to be raised. Did I just miss the colored line, or my eyes just tired?
It may just be difficult at that scale. The plan is to raise Poldike from the the intersection, if you will, with Way 672 to Hopkins Drive.
Okay, I didn't see that in the color, but
that is most certainly in the plan. It may not have been discernible at that scale, but it is proposed.
Okay, so the property from Hopkins to the end is not going to be raised.
Correct. You may recall that was a matter taken up by the Executive Council a couple of years ago, and there was an analysis of options for that very question considered, and the recommendation to proceed with elevating the portion roughly about 1,000 linear feet from Way 672 to Hopkins. The part of that analysis was that the remaining portion of Poldike would not be affected by tidal restoration, except under very extreme conditions in phase one. So that is where things stand currently.
But I believe that also included that during low tide, it would be accessible. Not high tide, but low tide.
Yeah,
I think more than just low tide, correct? Let's see, Jeff, did you want to weigh in on that particular question?
Yeah, you can take it, Carol. I was just going to say that section of road between Hopkins Drive and I guess wherever it hits Main Street or Poldike there, that would be accessible during most tidals. It would be really the extreme highs, and that would be when like we reach full restoration. So it would be accessible more than just at low tide.
Right. Correct. Yes.
Okay. Okay. I have a lot of neighbors that are interested. Thank you.
Very good. And I see Christine has her hand up. Christine, do you have a question or a comment?
No, I have a clarifying comment. Mm-hmm. The graphic that you displayed was prepared by Lewis Berger for the low-lying roads specifically. And it was not updated to reflect High Tosser Way 672. So Dave's eyes are functioning properly. The High Tosser Way 672 road segments are not colored on that graphic.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine.
All right. Good. Then let's go to the remaining portion of the update, which is just quickly to note the ongoing work we're doing in partnership with the Chequesset Club. This is another portion of property mitigation that will require the elevation of portions of the club property, the low-lying holes that would be accomplished using material or fill from the club's property It's also intended that a portion of fill from the club's property would be utilized for the elevation of low-lying road segments. So that work is underway. We're working closely with the design team and the club as partners in this. Again, this is grant-funded work that would be distributed via an agreement between the town and the Chukwesa Club. Also want to provide an update on the status of the Mill Creek Water Control Structure, and there may be others here, Jeff or others from the Park Service who can add further detail to this. But essentially this $8 million project element is under construction. Dredging's complete, the temporary bypass has been installed, and plans are to begin installing sheet piles on the south side of the creek and a temporary cofferdam. That work should begin in the next couple of weeks, I believe. The project, as of the regular progress meeting yesterday, is about 48.5% or 49% complete, and it's now looking like a completion sometime in late summer or early fall of 2025. Jeff, anything more you would want to add on that particular project update?
Yeah, thanks, Carol. I just talked to our representative, the Park Service representative on site today. He filled me in on some details that some folks in the area might be interested in. So first, a number of the sheet piles have been delivered. And I believe some of the H piles, which are the longer like I-beam type things, have been delivered. There's still some additional material to be delivered on site, but so there might be some truck traffic coming down that road. There's going to be a crane delivered to the site early next week. They're expecting the crane to arrive on Monday, and the crane is going to be used to actually move and drive these piles in. There's going to be a meeting on site on Wednesday that I'm going to try to attend, and it's going to talk about in more detail about their plans to drive the piles in. And I'll have some more information next week. And we can advise folks on a more clear timeline on that, when that will take place. It will create some noise and vibration, but they'll be operating only 4 days a week. Typically, they're Monday through Thursday when they're doing this stuff, and they don't operate past like 4 o'clock, so it won't be operating very late in the day either. But I'll have more information next week. But if anyone has any questions, you can let us know.
Excellent. Thank you. All right. So great progress there as well. Just to provide another update, so we've talked about the status of the construction elements, and of course, there's other work ongoing in terms of marsh management, notably vegetation clearing. And we've noted this a number of times in executive council meetings, but the vegetation clearing on federal land has involved the 125 acres of Salt Hill vegetation in Duck Harbor and an additional 25 acres west of Herring River, north and south of High Toss, which is part of the area that will be reached by tidal flow within the first 3 years of tidal restoration, which is the period of the approved tide gate management policy that the Executive Council voted some time ago. And then, of course, as we get closer to restoration, and the exact timing of this has yet to be determined, but close to restoration would be the timing of clearing of about 45 acres of Phragmites, which are located in Lower Herring River. At this point, in terms of any impacts to vegetation on private land, the current modeling assessment of the extent of water reaching these areas during the initial three-year tide gauge management policy would indicate that there are no impacts on private property during that time. Now, we are going to take another close look at that as we update the model, which we'll talk about in a moment, to make sure that even under updated model conditions, that is still the case. Now, we've had discussion at past meetings about funding for vegetation clearing, and the work that has been done to date has been funded through the grant that is flowing through the Ducks Unlimited, which is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service grant and that has funded the vegetation clearing and the planning for the marsh pilot projects that we have touched on and we'll touch on in a moment. And so that's also been augmented by funding from the National Park Foundation. And that's all gone toward work on all of the clearing to date has been on federal land. Now, the town's grant with the Natural Resources Conservation Service does include funding for marsh restoration and vegetation clearing on the order of about $700,000. That is not eligible to be used on federal land, but could be used on, I believe, municipal or private land to the extent that there is a need for vegetation clearing on private property. So that funding is actually part of the existing grant agreement between Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is a division of USDA, and the town. And then as additional vegetation clearing comes into focus on either federal or private land, if that's the case, then further grant sources will be pursued with lead time to accomplish that work. At this point, I'm just going to say a word about two marsh pilot projects that are in design. I believe we've noted these to you before. There's some additional detail to be added here, but to remind you that these are two small areas of the marsh plain that are being sort of designed as test projects to test different methods for dealing with the removal of the berms, using that material to reestablish marsh elevation, supporting the regrowth of salt marsh, and preserving or enhancing that carbon storage potential of the marsh. And we've been working with the agencies to develop the correct permitting pathway or authorization pathway for these pilot projects. And I would just like to invite Tim Smith, if you're on and listening, if you want to say any more. I have the two sites here listed. If you want to just remind everyone sort of generally the plans for these two pilot projects.
Sure. So as Carol said, we're working on two separate projects. They're related in that they are both addressing subsided surface elevation. The idea is to bring in material to supplement the marsh elevation and get the surface back to where it will sync up with the restored tidal range that the marshes are inundated and drained properly with each high tide. You can go to the next slide, Carol. So the first of these we call the Burn Project. This is up by Merrick Island between High Toss and Bound Brook Road. This section of the river was channelized about 100 years ago, and there's berms that were created by dredging salt marsh soil and piling it off to the side, created these large linear obstructions to tidal flow that in themselves are not conducive to habitat function we're trying to restore. So we intend to remove that material and then reuse it in subsided areas to elevate the surface. And you can see here the berms are pointed out. There's about 4,000 linear feet, totaling about 10,000 yards if we removed all of it. The box highlighted says marsh restoration area is a very low area that we would use a portion of that material to restore, to raise that back to the elevation so it would be flooded and then drained at low tide. Right now, it's very, very wet. It's very low. If we didn't do anything there, when salt water comes back, it will fill up. It'll be even wetter than it is now. Probably be in standing salt water, certainly too wet, too waterlogged to regrow the vegetation that we're aiming for as one of the goals of the project. So that's the one area. The next area is down by Mill Creek here, right at the mouth of Mill Creek. very close to where the water control structure is being built. This is an area where we're bringing in soil from outside, so we don't have a source right there of material like we do in the other site. So we're, for the small area, it's about an acre and a half, we intend to restore low area that is currently supporting salt marsh. But when we open up tide gates and increase the tide range, that will be too low in comparison to the restored tide range. So we're bringing in the material, basically sand, graded to a very specific elevation that would support continued growth of salt marsh vegetation after tides are restored there. So those are the two projects. We have consultants, engineering consultants working on designs and plans for these that we intend to put into permit applications over the next few months, and hopefully construct these sometime next year.
Thank you, Tim. And just to, you know, add on to what Tim just said, I mean, so it's conceivable that there will be matters coming, you know, MEPA public comment period or, hearing before the Conservation Commission in the coming months to review these projects in more detail. So we'll certainly keep you posted on that progress. All right. And guess I'll move right on then to the next topic, which is the model update.
Harold?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead.
Helen. Yeah, you didn't offer question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, forgive me. Okay. So many of us, or some of us at least, may remember that when the issue of Phragmites clearing came up back quite a few years ago, before permitting had happened, but it was very controversial. And although the National Seashore can anywhere in the country use pesticides to manage vegetation and other things, you know, the label being the law, they have to do it in a legal way. In this project, it was decided after quite a lot of controversy that pesticides would not be used to manage Phragmites, which can choke this kind of restoration in places. And I would like just everybody to be brought up to date with the techniques that are now being proposed to manage Phragmites as the project, you know, continues. And just to sort of underline this, because we have a number of people who weren't around for that very detailed discussion of that over a number of meetings by a number of different groups. And so perhaps Tim can do this or Jeff, but can we have sort of a recap of how you're going to deal with the Phragmites, please?
Helen, did you mean herbicides and not pesticides?
Pesticides, that's a term that covers all the subsections, rodenticides, herbicides,
insecticides.
Yeah, pesticides is everything. So I said pesticides, yes. For herbicides is the subsection of pesticides. Thank you.
And just to certainly invite others, Jeff or Tim, if you want to weigh in, but I believe the policy adopted or the kind of finding adopted by the Executive Council was to not seek permission to use herbicides in phase one of the in environmental permits for the restoration project. So that was the language of the consensus that was reached at that time.
That was my memory and what I read to refresh myself. And thank you for restating that commitment, which was very important. Thank you.
Well, I can take a stab at answering Helen's question, and I'm sure Tim can step in and provide more detail if necessary. But I think the plan right now is to time the cutting of the Phragmites so that it'll be cut during the time of year when it's relatively dormant. And then when the plant will become right around the time then the plant would become more active. Hopefully that would be, the timing would be in sync with when additional salt water would be entering the system. Therefore, as the plant tries to grow, it's going to be impacted more by the introduction of salt water, and thereby hopefully killing the Phragmites and making it making that habitat available for the types of species we're looking for, like the Spartinus species, Ultramiflora and Patens, Distichlis and things like that. That I believe that that is the plan. We will we'll have to see how that works. Tim, I don't know if you have anything else or if any other details to add.
Well, that's about it for now. I mean, it's pretty simple. Just basically cut it and flood it with salt water, which has been effective in other locations.
Great. Thank you, guys. All right. So with that, just to move on to an update on modeling. So I think this topic was discussed in brief. We didn't have an opportunity to get into an extended discussion at the last Executive Council meeting, but we did want to provide an update on the status of the model update. So this is the model that has been used to predict post-restoration water levels throughout the system, and it will be updated. We've been working with the model provider, Woods Hole Group, on a detailed scope that would incorporate a number of updates, including information about the Duck Harbor breach as the entry point of tidal waters, and simulating those conditions. So I do want to note here too, because I know it seems like it takes a long time for this type of modeling scope to be thought through, but it is rather complex. And one of the benefits of the earlier work that I spoke of related to the low roads is, which was also conducted by Woods Hole Group, is it was an opportunity for them to really assimilate all of that new data and understand it. So that is going to be, and they really wanted to go through that exercise before taking the further, more detailed step to scope out the model update, because they would have a much better understanding of the data available to depict those changing conditions. So that actually is a kind of a stepwise process that's been very, very effective in this instance. So they also will be incorporating additional data that's been collected since the modeling was originally done on water surface elevation and salinity and other factors. They will incorporate any design modifications that may have evolved over the past couple of years having to do with structures. And then they will be in a position to simulate different alternative restoration activities, such as different configurations of tide gates and things of that sort. So that that scoping is still in process, and we expect the modeling to begin early next year. That information will be useful in a number of different ways to inform tide gate management settings. So the Executive Council has established a tide gate management policy that will guide the first 3 years of tidal restoration. So once the bridge project is completed and tide gates are available to begin manipulation, then we have a policy that will govern that first 3 years of implementation. And during that time, with this updated model and additional data being collected, that will provide information that will inform options for subsequent tide gate management policies to be considered by the Executive Council. It will also, as noted earlier, be helpful in refining plans for vegetation and marsh management. So a number of different uses for this model, which, you know, we are looking forward to continuing to report to the Executive Council on the progress as this work continues. So I think that is the end. Oh, I guess there's one more topic we did want to just sort of put on the table in the way of the work that's ongoing with the technical team and our project partners, is to continue to think about the proper approach to data sharing and archiving. So a technical team is working with our partners to explore those long-term options. beginning with an inventory of all of the data that's available. And there's data that is publicly accessible, but it might be housed at different, some of it might be housed with the seashore, some of it might be housed with other of our partners. So we're looking for a way to make it easier for anyone who might be interested in accessing data to have more like a one-stop shopping approach. We're going to be developing a more detailed, robust data sharing plan. And there are data sharing protocols in effect. I want to make that clear. Those are required by our funding partners. But this will be, again, an effort to make this a more accessible, usable, shareable data management system. And of course, in doing all of this planning and thinking through, we'll be identifying some long-term resource needs for organizing this effort and then implementing it. So much more work to be done there, but it is an important topic. And we did want to make everyone, the Executive Council and others, aware that it is certainly something on the docket for our attention. So I will stop there, as that is the end of our project updates. And before we move on to other topics on the agenda, I would just ask our Executive Council members if you have any questions or comments on any of those additional reports. Jeff?
Yeah, Carol, thank you. I just wanted to quickly mention that we've received some reports from folk, from our representative on site at the Mill Creek construction area, that every once in a while there are pedestrians kind of walking into that construction zone. That during the day when they're there, the gate at the end of Old Chequesset Neck Road is open. It is an active construction site, so just wanted to remind folks that please don't walk in there unaccompanied. If anyone is interested in some sort of tour or something like that, if you want, please let us know, the Park Service know, we can try to arrange something. But understand, this isn't like something we can do all the time. I mean, here and there, we can try to arrange some things, but it is an active construction site. And for everyone's safety, even though that gate might be open, please don't walk on site without without them knowing you're coming or that you're accompanied by someone.
Thank you, Jeff. Helen? You're on mute, Helen.
I try to be so careful so you don't hear the dog. Anyway, thank you very much for including the archiving, a future agenda item. More specifically, and it needs to be identified on the agenda as such specifically. I'm interested in a report on what archiving has been done and by which group up until now and how far back. That's number one. Number two, I'd like to hear from all of us on the HREC how we think this should be done going forward. And also a reference to best practices from the Public Records Agency, which I've read in the deep past, I don't know if they're the same, about storing and maintaining digital archives. And the reason I think it's very important for us to look at it closely is this is going to be going on forever, this project, in a sense. And this group, as the deciders, are going to exist going forward, right? And we need to be able to access, and it won't be the people that are necessarily involved now, easily what has already been discussed and what data there is, because this archive should contain data so that anybody can reach for it and find it in a pretty quick way. How much time has been spent looking for that kind of information in my experience for 25 years? It's just outrageous. It's a time sink And the people on the HRTT are very aware of this and you know, numerous occasions. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Helen. All right, so that that concludes project updates. The next item on the agenda is the Herring River Stakeholder Group update. And I would like to welcome Bill Biwenga, Chair, to address the Executive Council with any updates from the stakeholder group. Bill, you're on mute if you're speaking. Bill may have stepped away. I would, in until he returns, I would like to maybe make a couple of notes. One is to acknowledge with gratitude the many contributions of Laura Runkle, a long-term charter stakeholder group member who passed away recently. And we certainly are sorry for her passing, and also just want to take a moment to gratefully acknowledge the careful attention she paid to the project and her time spent in these meetings and also in stakeholder group meetings, contributing in that manner as well. So I know that was one of the points that Bill had intended to make as well. Bill, please chime in if you are able to unmute at any point. There also is a stakeholder group meeting planned for November 21st at 3 p.m. So a Thursday at 3 p.m. I think was felt to be consistent with kind of this meeting time, which seems to work for a lot of folks. That will be a virtual meeting via Zoom. Yeah, I guess Bill's having difficulty with his mic. So I believe that link has been circulated through the Friends of Herring River eNews and by Bill and others. But if anyone doesn't have it, it certainly will be posted as well as a public meeting at the town on the town website as well. But certainly feel free to reach out to Bill or to me if anyone is having difficulty finding that access information. But that that meeting again is November 21st. I guess lastly, in light of Laura's passing and there would be a need to appoint a replacement to her position. So that would be brought to the board at your next meeting in December, a candidate for your consideration. There also, at Bill's suggestion, the Executive Council appoints the chair and vice chair. There currently is not a vice chair. So we would invite the Executive Council to consider candidates for vice chair at your December meeting as well. So there will be more information coming from Bill on those points prior to your next meeting on December 19th. All right. So at this point, we can move on to any Executive Council member announcements. Helen?
Hi, just to remind you all that on Saturday from 9 to 12, the State of the Harbor conference is going to be held this year at the Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater. And I find that there's always a lot of overlap from what I learned there to this committee's work. So just telling you, you know, you can walk in. They ask you to register, but, you know, I've walked in. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen. Hold on, Dave, it's going to be public comment in a minute. This is just the member announcements. I'm not sure if there are any more.
I was just in conversation with Bill, and he has two requests.
Oh, okay, sure.
Okay. You've already talked about Laura, but he's suggesting that somebody needs to supply or refer a replacement for her. So that's number one. And the second is that he'd like some help in determining a vice chair for this stakeholders group meeting. So, Bill, hopefully I got it right. Okay. His mic is not working. He's with us, but he's just not able to talk.
We've all had those moments on Zoom.
Okay.
So thank you, Bill. Thank you, Dave. And thank you for those notes. We will make sure those are addressed in the December meeting. Any other member announcements? Okay, I'm not seeing any. So that would bring us to public comment. If there's any further public comment, Josh Yeston.
Hi, I again appreciate the opportunity to speak. Once again, I'm going to ask this committee to reconsider their position on Duck Harbor Road. My concerns are well noted in the public record, but it is a matter of safety to my family and to others on Griffin Island. You know, Ms. Ridley, I so appreciate everything you do. I do want to ask that you correct yourself. You've stated a number of times in public meetings that Duck Harbor Road is impassable by motor vehicle. That's just not true. I drive down that road every week. And so I understand there might be other reasons why you may not want to raise the road. But I would appreciate if we stop saying that it's not passable, because it is. I hope that this committee might bring it up in a further agenda item at your next meeting to reconsider and discuss the opportunities you might have to save the road. You know, it's a town road in the park. So I asked the question previously because I was curious who I'd need to speak to try to get this on the agenda. You know, it's really important to me and my family, and I do appreciate the time you give me to continue to advocate, and I always will. So thank you very much.
This is not an agenda item, so we're not going to get into a discussion about it. But if there's anything, about the ownership and maintenance of that road, I think there's more to be said about that. So I would defer to the executive council if there's anything more you feel it's appropriate to say today, or if you'd like to address this at a later time.
I think we should put it on as an agenda item for the next meeting.
Me too. Helen says me too.
All right.
Jeff?
Yeah, I'm fine with putting it on as an agenda item. It'll give us some time to gather some more information and be more prepared to speak to it.
Very good. Thank you. Any further public comment?
Well, I had one more small thing. First of all, Wes has done an incredible job, and I love seeing him on the bridge. I drive by him almost every day. He did state in his update that they believe that completion of the bridge is now going to go into 2026. I think it's the first time that's been said in a public meeting, and I think it would be just appropriate to let the select board know so the rest of the public is aware that they're going to move beyond their April 7th, 2025 substantial completion deadline. I think it would be helpful for people in the community to know that the construction will continue. Thank you.
Noted, Josh. Thanks. I will be addressing the select board shortly. I anticipate this month at the November 12th, and I'll look to update them appropriately.
Is there any further public comment? I'm not seeing any hands up. All right, well, that concludes our agenda for this afternoon. And the next meeting of the Executive Council is scheduled for Thursday, December 19th at 3 p.m. via Zoom. So with that, I would invite the Executive Council members to adjourn by consensus.
Helen,
Debbie.
Hi.
Debbie says yes.
Yeah, bye.
Great. Thank you very much to our Executive Council members and to all of you for joining us this afternoon. Have a good rest of the day.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Happy Halloween.
Yeah, trick or treat, guys. Bye.